Chapter 17. Simplon into Switzerland. I had been half afraid to go to Verona, lest it should at all put me out of conceit with Romeo and Juliet. But, I was no sooner come into the old marketplace, than the misgiving vanished. It is so fanciful, quaint, and picturesque a place, formed by such an extraordinary and rich variety of fantastic buildings, that there could be nothing better at the core of even this romantic town. Scene of one of the most romantic and beautiful of stories. It was natural enough to go straight from the marketplace to the house of the Capulets, now degenerated into a most miserable little inn. Noisy vetturini and muddy market carts were disputing possession of the yard, which was ankle-deep in dirt, with a brood of splashed and bespattered geese, and there was a grim-visaged dog, viciously panting in a doorway, who would certainly have had Romeo by the leg, the moment he put it over the wall, if he had existed, and been at large in those times. The orchard fell into other hands, and was parted off many years ago, but there used to be one attached to the house, or at all events there may have been, and the at Capello, the ancient cognizance of the family, may still be seen, carved in stone, over the gateway of the yard. The geese, the market carts, their drivers, and the dog, were somewhat in the way of the story, it must be confessed, and it would have been pleasanter to have found the house empty, and to have been able to walk through the disused rooms. But the hat was unspeakably comfortable, and the place where the garden used to be, hardly less so. Besides, the house is a distrustful, jealous-looking house as one would desire to see, though of a very moderate size. So I was quite satisfied with it, as the veritable mansion of old Capulet, and was correspondingly grateful in my acknowledgments to an extremely unsentimental middle-aged lady, the padrona of the hotel, who was lounging on the threshold looking at the geese, and who at least resembled the Capulets in the one particular of being very great indeed in the family way. From Juliet's home to Juliet's tomb is a transition as natural to the visitor as to fair Juliet herself, or to the proudest Juliet that ever has taught the torches to burn bright in any time. So, I went off, with a guide, to an old garden, once belonging to an old convent, I suppose, and being admitted, at a shattered gate, by a bright-eyed woman who was washing clothes, went down some walks, where fresh plants and young flowers were prettily growing among fragments of old wall, and ivy-colored mounds, and was shown a little tank, or water trough, which the bright-eyed woman drying her arms upon her kerchief, called La Tomba di Giulietta la Sfortunata. Apostrophe with the best disposition in the world to believe, I could do no more than believe, that the bright-eyed woman believed. So I gave her that much credit, and her customary fee in ready money. It was a pleasure, rather than a disappointment, that Juliet's resting place was forgotten. However consolatory it may have been to Yorick's ghost, to hear the feet upon the pavement overhead, and 20 times a day, the repetition of his name, it is better for Juliet to lie out of the track of tourists, and to have no visitors, but such as come to graves in spring rain, and sweet air, and sunshine. Pleasant Verona, with its beautiful old palaces, and charming country in the distance, seen from terrace walks, and stately, balustraded galleries, with its Roman gates, still spanning the fair street, and casting, on the sunlight of today, the shade of 1500 years ago, with its marble-fitted churches, lofty towers, rich architecture, and quaint old quiet thoroughfares, where shouts of Montagues and Capulets once resounded, and made Verona's ancient citizens cast by their grave, beseeming ornaments, to wield old partisans. With its fast-rushing river, picturesque old bridge, great castle, waving cypresses, and prospect so delightful, and so cheerful. Pleasant Verona. in the midst of it, in the Piazza di Brai spirit of old time among the familiar realities of the passing hours the great Roman amphitheater, so well preserved, and carefully maintained, that every row of seats is there, unbroken. Over certain of the arches, the old Roman numerals may yet be seen, and there are corridors, and staircases, and subterranean passages for beasts, and winding ways, above ground and below, as when the fierce thousands hurried in and out, intent upon the bloody shows of the arena. Nestling in some of the shadows and hollow places of the walls, now, are smiths with their forges, and a few small dealers of one kind or other, and there are green weeds, and leaves, and grass, upon the parapet. But little else is greatly changed. When I had traversed all about it, with great interest, and had gone up to the topmost round of seats, and turning from the lovely panorama closed in by the distant Alps, looked down into the building, it seemed to lie before me like the inside of a prodigious hat of plaited straw, with an enormously broad brim and a shallow crown, the plates being represented by the 44 rows of seats. The comparison is a homely and fantastic one, in sober remembrance and on paper, but it was irresistibly suggested at the moment, nevertheless. An equestrian troop had been there, a short time before the same troop, I dare say, that appeared to the old lady in the church at Medina, and had scooped out a little ring at one end of the area, where their performances had taken place, and where the marks of their horses' feet were still fresh. I could not but picture to myself a handful of spectators gathered together on one or two of the old stone seats, and a spangled cavalier being gallant, or a Polisinello funny, with the grim walls looking on. Above all, I thought how strangely those Roman mutes would gaze upon the favorite comic scene of the traveling English, where a British nobleman, Lord John, with a very loose stomach, dressed in a blue tailed coat down to his heels, bright yellow breeches, and a white hat, comes abroad, riding double on a rearing horse, with an English lady, Lady Betsy, in a straw bonnet and green veil, and a red spencer, and who always carries a gigantic reticule, and a put-up parasol. I walked through and through the town all the rest of the day, and could have walked there until now, I think. In one place, there was a very pretty modern theater, where they had just performed the opera always popular in Verona, of Romeo and Juliet. In another there was a collection, under a colonnade, of Greek, Roman, and Etruscan remains, presided over by an ancient man who might have been an Etruscan relic himself, for he was not strong enough to open the iron gate when he had unlocked it, and had neither voice enough to be audible when he described the curiosities, nor sight enough to see them. He was so very old. In another place, there was a gallery of pictures, so abominably bad that it was quite delightful to see them moldering away. But anywhere, in the churches, among the palaces, in the streets, on the bridge, or down beside the river, it was always pleasant Verona, and in my remembrance always will be. I read Romeo and Juliet in my own room at the inn, that night of course, no Englishman had ever read it there, before, and set out for Mantua next day at sunrise, repeating to myself in the coupe of an omnibus, and next to the conductor, who was reading the Mysteries of Paris, "There is no world without Verona's walls but purgatory, torture, hell itself. Hence banished is banished from the world, and world's exile is death," which reminded me that Romeo was only banished 25 miles after all, and rather disturbed my confidence in his energy and boldness. Was the way to Mantua as beautiful, in his time, I wonder? Did it wind through pasture land as green, bright with the same glancing streams, and dotted with fresh clumps of graceful trees? Those purple mountains lay on the horizon, then, for certain, and the dresses of these peasant girls, who wear a great, knobbed, silver pin like an English life preserver through their hair behind, can hardly be much changed. The hopeful feeling of so bright a morning, and so exquisite a sunrise, can have been no stranger, even to an exiled lover's breast, and Mantua itself must have broken on him in the prospect, with its towers, and walls, and water, pretty much as on a commonplace and matrimonial omnibus. He made the same sharp twists and turns, perhaps, over two rumbling drawbridges, passed through the like long, covered, wooden bridge, and leaving the marshy water behind, approached the rusty gate of stagnant Mantua. If ever a man were suited to his place of residence, and his place of residence to him, the lean apothecary and Mantua came together in a perfect fitness of things. It may have been more stirring than, perhaps. If so, the apothecary was a man in advance of his time, and knew what Mantua would be, in 1844. He fasted much, and that assisted him in his foreknowledge. I put up at the Hotel of the Golden Lion, and was in my own room arranging plans with the brave courier, when there came a modest little tap at the door, which opened on an outer gallery surrounding a courtyard, and an intensely shabby little man looked in, to inquire if the gentleman would have a cicerone to show the town. His face was so very wistful and anxious, in the half-open doorway, and there was so much poverty expressed in his faded suit and little pinched hat, and in the threadbare worsted glove with which he held it not expressed the less, because these were evidently his genteel clothes, hastily slipped on, that I would as soon have trodden on him as dismissed him. I engaged him on the instant, and he stepped in directly. While I finished the discussion in which I was engaged, he stood, beaming by himself in a corner, making a feint of brushing my hat with his arm. If his fee had been as many Napoleons as it was francs, there could not have shot over the twilight of his shabbiness such a gleam of sun, as lighted up the whole man, now that he was hired. Well, said I, when I was ready, shall we go out now? If the gentleman pleases. It is a beautiful day. A little fresh, but charming, altogether charming. The gentleman will allow me to open the door. This is the inn yard. The courtyard of the Golden Lion. The gentleman will please to mind his footing on the stairs. We were now in the street. This is the street of the Golden Lion. This, the outside of the Golden Lion. The interesting window up there, on the first piano, where the pane of glass is broken, is the window of the gentleman's chamber. Having viewed all these remarkable objects, I inquired if there were much to see in Mantua. Well, truly, no. Not much. He said, shrugging his shoulders apologetically. Many churches? No. Nearly all suppressed by the French. Monasteries or convents. No. The French again. Nearly all suppressed by Napoleon. Much business? Very little business. Many strangers? Ah heaven. I thought he would have fainted. Then, when we have seen the two large churches yonder, what shall we do next? Said one. He looked up the street, and down the street, and rubbed his chin timidly, and then said, glancing in my face, as if a light had broken on his mind, yet with a humble appeal to my forbearance, that was perfectly irresistible. We can take a little turn about the town, Signor.
Scipio far un piccolo giro della città.
It was impossible to be anything but delighted with the proposal, so we set off together in great good humor. In the relief of his mind, he opened his heart, and gave up as much of Mantua as a cicerone could. One must eat, he said. But, bah, it was a dull place, without doubt. He made as much as possible of the Basilica of Santa Andrea, a noble church, and of an enclosed portion of the pavement, about which tapers were burning, and a few people kneeling, and under which is said to be preserved the sangreal of the old romances.
this church disposed of, and another after it the Cathedral of San Pietro. We went to the museum, which was shut up. It was all the same, apostrophe he said. Bah! There was not much inside. Apostrophe then, we went to see the Piazza del Diavolo, built by the devil for no particular purpose, in a single night. Then, the Piazza Virgiliana. Then, the statue of Virgil our poet, my little friend said, plucking up a spirit, for the moment, and putting his hat a little on one side. Then, we went to a dismal sort of farmyard, by which a picture gallery was approached. The moment the gate of this retreat was opened, some 500 geese came waddling round us, stretching out their necks, and clamoring in the most hideous manner, as if they were ejaculating, oh! Here's somebody come to see the pictures. Don't go up. Don't go up. Apostrophe while we went up, they waited very quietly about the door in a crowd, cackling to one another occasionally, in a subdued tone. But the instant we appeared again, their necks came out like telescopes, and setting up a great noise, which meant, I have no doubt, what, you would go, would you? What do you think of it? How do you like it? Apostrophe they attended us to the outer gate, and cast us forth, derisively, into Mantua. The geese who saved the capital were, as compared to these, pork to the learned pig. What a gallery it was! I would take their opinion on a question of art, in preference to the discourses of Sir Joshua Reynolds. Now that we were standing in the street, after being thus ignominiously escorted thither, my little friend was plainly reduced to the piccolo gyro, apostrophe or little circuit of the town, he had formerly proposed. But my suggestion, that we should visit the Palazzo T, of which I had heard a great deal, as a strange wild place, imparted new life to him, and away we went. The secret of the length of Midas's ears would have been more extensively known if that servant of his, who whispered it to the reeds, had lived in Mantua, where there are reeds and rushes enough to have published it to all the world. The Palazzo T stands in a swamp, among this sort of vegetation, and is, indeed, as singular a place as I ever saw. Not for its dreariness, though it is very dreary. Not for its dampness, though it is very damp. Nor for its desolate condition, though it is as desolate and neglected as house can be. But chiefly for the unaccountable nightmares with which its interior has been decorated, among other subjects of more delicate execution, by Giulio Romano. There is a leering giant over a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.